now that healthcare reform is dead, is tax reform on the table? And what does that mean for your Social Security? A closer look just ahead. Good Monday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime or on iTunes, or stream us live right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, after the big healthcare defeat in the Senate last week, lawmakers are trying to pivot to tax reform. How will that be accomplished? What does that mean for your retirement benefits? A closer look. Coming up, give us a call right now and get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, this month's First Coast Success spotlights local CEO and philanthropist Barbara Drake. Plus, Culpepper on the Jags hopes as training camp begins, and a look at the rest of the weekend sports news and notes. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, it is the mother of all safety nets. Social Security is 82 years old this year. And for many Americans, Social Security is nothing short of indispensable. The Social Security Administration says 61% of retired workers getting benefits count on that check for at least half of their monthly income. And according to a new study from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, more than 40% of seniors in America would be living below the poverty line if it wasn't for that Social Security income every month. That begs the question, just how solvent is Social Security? Will you be able to count on your check when you retire? And as Congress and the Trump administration try to move forward on their plans for tax reform, how are programs like Social Security likely to be affected? We begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome Dr. John O'Brien, professor at Flagler College and CEO of Vista Energy Group. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to see you. And here's our question to callers. What are your concerns about your retirement? What are your questions about the future of Social Security? What would you like to see done to make sure the program stays strong for decades to come? Give us a call right now. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page where we are streaming live right now. All right, let's begin with, first off, the failure of repeal and replace Obamacare. That went down in the Senate last week. Republicans had hoped to pivot from that successful effort to some tax cuts. They had hoped to save some money from repealing President Obama's big achievement, health care reform, to looking at ways we could simplify the tax code, provide tax cuts, and more. So that's sort of the political backdrop, Dr. O'Brien, to all of this. As the administration looks to pivot to tax reform this week, for years, fiscal conservatives have said we can't do tax reform unless we look at the three third rails of American politics, Social Security, Medicare, and defense spending. Let's talk for this discussion mainly about Social Security because you're an expert on that. Let me ask you first of all, is the program solvent?
It's very solvent. Actually, it's not going broke. You'll hear that a lot in the debate that's coming up. There is almost a $3 trillion surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund. And in fact, it is profitable in 2016, while paying out about $880 billion in benefits. It also collected $107 trillion in payroll taxes. And I think that one important thing about whether it's going broke or not is when you get your paycheck, take a look at that paycheck, and you'll see something called a FICA deduction. Well, that goes into almost entirely the Social Security Trust Fund. That's your money being put aside by our government for your retirement. The problem is, and I will get into this in greater detail in a minute, but the situation is such that that will not go on forever. The other thing that I think is important to recognize, and you'll hear this a lot, is that you will hear them say Social Security is the biggest driver of our deficit. That is completely false. The Social Security system has nothing to do with our deficit.
What is the biggest driver of the deficit?
Well, there are a lot of drivers of the deficit, but I would be more concerned about Medicare and Medicaid. And I think it's important to realize Social Security is not an entitlement program. Those other two are. Social Security is something you paid for. Mm-hmm. Your money's
in, money out.
That's all it is. As a matter of fact, if you look at the health care issues, you've got doctors, lawyers, nurses, you've got all kinds of different things going on, drug prescription costs and so on. There's nothing complicated about Social Security at all. It's very, very
You pay into
simple.
It your whole life for a minimum of 35 years, right, doctor? And then beginning at age 62, or if you wait a little longer, you start getting that money back in the form of a monthly check. And by the way, if you have questions about the future of Social Security, up on Capitol Hill, they pivot to the issue of tax reform. Give us a call. What are your thoughts about this? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, as you just said, the program is solvent, ending 2016 with nearly $3 trillion in reserves. However, last year, Social Security trustees report suggested that by the year 2034, in 17 years, those asset reserves could be depleted. So between now and 2034, fiscal hawks have said we have to tweak this program. How should it be addressed? And so what are your thoughts about potential solutions to make sure that the checks keep coming, frankly?
Well, let me go over the numbers very quickly first, because I think the idea that it's going to be broke in 2034, first of all, is wrong.
Why is that wrong?
Well, because they'll still be able to pay out almost 80% of the benefits at that stage. That's not broke. The problem is, of course, that 20% is something, as you mentioned in your lead, that's something that people do depend on. But I think what's
80% of what they were expecting is probably not going to make a lot of people happy, that they were expecting 100%.
No, and I will go over the solutions in a minute, but I think there are a couple things that are important in terms of dates. The fact is that until 2022, the amount of money coming into the Social Security Trust Fund is more than what's going out, period. So until 2022,
five more years. Let me just jump in. Isn't it because so many boomers are retiring and getting their benefits that we're looking at this issue, that big demographic bulge of people that are going to be wanting their checks? That's what's driving this, isn't it?
There are two things. That is one, the worker to beneficiary ratio now is 2.8. It's going to go down so that the number of workers supporting the number of retirees will change. But the other thing is life expectancy. Life expectancy has gone up dramatically. So those two things are putting us in that situation. I want to point out one specific thing, though. Do you know the millennial generation is bigger than the baby boom generation?
Yeah, I've heard something about that basically every single day.
Okay.
We are told this. We Generation Xers, yes, we hear this daily, and yes, I'm very much aware. But go ahead.
But what the problem is that when you start cashing out, the trust fund buys treasury bonds. That's what it does with its money. It's surplus. Well, it's going to have to start after 2022 cashing those bonds in. And the question is, where does the money come from? And that's where the deficit hawks will say, oh, it affects the deficit. It does not. In fact, the amount of the deficit that is Social Security is fairly small. 67% of the deficit is owned to Americans, not to foreigners, not to anybody else. Now, what they'll have to do is borrow the money to pay the money. But that doesn't affect the deficit. Will stay exactly the same either way. So what will happen during the period from 2022 to 2034, we will be cashing in those reserves until they run out. That is the problem. Now, that's a long ways away. Of course, if you're under 55 and you're looking at Social Security, that's not so far away.
Exactly. We'll go to your calls in a moment on this at 549-2937. So you're looking at cutting benefits, raising taxes, or some combination of the two to adjust and balance Social Security, correct? And what, in your view, is the right combination of those two solutions?
Well, I think that you're going to... What's the right solution? The right solution depends on who you are. If you're the person who doesn't want to pay more taxes, period, you're going to be in favor of cutting benefits. If you're the person receiving the benefits or likely to receive the benefits, you're going to want to raise the taxes. Now, just what are the solutions? There are two solutions. One is you could raise the payroll tax from 12.4%, which is, again, the FICA deduction on your payroll check, to 15%. That would be a slight increase. That fixes the problem. Another way to do it is, many people don't realize this, but once you earn $127,000, you pay no FICA tax after that. So if you make $150,000, the difference between $127,000 and $150,000, there's no FICA tax. So another way to fix it is to raise that threshold, which has been done over the years.
You make it sound so simple, but in politics, nothing is simple. How big of a political fight do you anticipate over this as the two sides grapple with just seemingly irreconcilable positions?
Well, as Eric Brady, the chairman of the tax committee, put it, he said, we're not going to tax our way out of this, period. Now, that is a uniquely tax hawk response. But I think that that is one side of it. But the other side of it is cutting benefits. And how do you do that? Well, you do something like the cost of living increases. You change the formula. You go to something called chained CPI. Now, I could tell you all about that, but what it comes down to is it reduces benefits by about 30% for the people that we're talking to right now who would like to retire. So does that work?
What age group is that?
Well, anybody, I would say anybody under 55. The typical type of reform that they talk about is for people under 55.
So basically, people that have had the expectation of getting these benefits their entire working lives, when they get to the finish line, they're going to be told, your check's going to be about 30% smaller than your parents' check was. That's not going to go over well.
Well, no, and it shouldn't, actually, especially given the fact that you have a situation where there about 7% of wage earners earn more than $127,000 a year. They don't pay taxes over that into FICA. Raising that, which is raising taxes, but only raising taxes on people who make that much money. Now, I will be going over the Republican and Democratic proposals for fixing this in a moment.
Yeah, we'll do that in a moment. But first, we're going to go to your calls. As the Trump administration and Congress try to pivot to the issue of tax reform this week in Washington, what are your questions and concerns about your retirement? As we speak with Social Security expert Dr. John O'Brien of Flagler College, 549-549-2937. Give us a call. Let's start with Wells in Atlantic Beach. Wells, good morning.
Good morning, Wilson. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I think another way to look at this, and by the way, I am retired. I'm 71 years old, and I'm very concerned about Social Security. But another way to look at this is that ever since Social Security was created, the very wealthy, the 1%, has been trying to get rid of it because they don't want to pay taxes, basically. And they see any services given to the 99%, the working class, as socialist, as communist. And we need to really understand why all this is happening. They don't pay taxes, and they want the workers to be on their knees, basically.
Wait, let me just jump in. You're saying, you just said they don't pay taxes.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is billionaires in this country, like the Koch brothers, the Mellon family, they do not pay their fair share of taxes, and a lot of times they don't pay taxes at all. And a lot of these corporations that move into areas like Jacksonville, for instance, they only come in when they get a sweetheart deal where they don't have to pay taxes.
Or put another way, they find loopholes to minimize their tax
exactly.
burden.
Yeah.
And okay. So what's your question then about Social Security?
Well, I think what I'm saying is we need to understand that, and that needs to be part of the puzzle here. It's not just about workers putting into Social Security. Okay, and Social Security is solvent; it's not going to go broke. But the issue here is, why are people trying to take Social Security, put it in the stock market, do whatever they want to do with it? They want to end it. And this has been something that, since it was created back during Roosevelt, that the rich have been trying to get rid of. And I'm sure everybody, you know, would agree with that.
All right. Thanks, Wells. Do you think conservatives would like to get rid of Social Security? That's one. And his second point, do you think wealthier individuals and corporations should be paying more of the freight for these types of programs?
Well, first of all, corporations don't pay into Social Security except to the extent that they share the 50-50 split typically. In other words, that little portion that you see on your paycheck, they pay the other half of that into Social Security.
Yeah, they're paying something.
But aside from that, that they don't. Now, I think it's important to recognize that Social Security is part of the New Deal, which happened back in the 30s. Medicare and Medicaid were part of the
Great Society.
Yes, that was Lyndon Johnson. So they're not connected. And I think that the caller, Wells, is correct in the sense that there has been an element of our body politic that has been against Social Security from the day it was formed, and really against taxation in general. But I think Social Security has been the shiny object in a sense.
That said, it's long also been called the third rail of politics. There's a strong bipartisan reluctance to say out loud, "Oh, we can't afford to do this program." It's popular with retirees of all political stripes. So, getting rid of it, who at the national political level is going to credibly suggest that? That does not seem feasible.
Well, I think, first of all, it isn't feasible because I think that it is something that is baked into our whole society. We expect Social Security to happen. But I also think that it's important to recognize, and I started this off at the top of the show here, they're going to say that Social Security is the major driver of the deficit. They're going to say that over and over and over again until somebody believes it. It is simply not true. The Social Security system has nothing to do with the deficit.
And what about his other point that he thinks, and of course his comments get at the political divide in this country, he thinks wealthier Americans should be taxed more heavily to ensure that programs like Social Security remain solvent for all?
Well, I think you've got a big problem, which is what Wells was referring to, our caller, but then you've got the smaller problems. And what we're addressing right here is what I would consider the smaller taxation issue, which is how to keep Social Security solvent through 75 years. That is the horizon that is out there in legislation, is 75 years.
And keep in mind, too, as the Hill starts looking at tax reform, what's going to be talked about is the exact opposite of everything you're saying, across-the-board tax cuts, not looking at the revenue side to shore up anything.
Well, that's more than likely. On the other hand, I doubt we'll get reconciliation in terms of the Senate on that, and therefore there will be 60 votes needed. So I don't really see the entire restructuring of the tax program going down on a 51-vote margin. So I think that there will be pushback, and I think the pushback will be appropriate. But again, when we talk about Social Security, there's an issue of fairness that doesn't really exist in many of the other, like, for instance, is it fair that you cut Medicaid? Some would say yes, some would say no. Is it fair that you cut Social Security? Very few people would say yes, that's fair.
Still, though, as you heard from his call, there's a lot of worry out there about the program. Let's take a few more calls. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I guess you can kind of count me as one that I'm not completely happy with Social Security, not from the standpoint I'm real cold-hearted, but all the money that I'm having to put into Social Security, number one, your guess kind of makes it sound like, well, I will get all of that money back. Well, what happens if I die early? Well, my spouse gets a benefit, but it isn't, my understanding is it's not equal to the amount that I would get if I was still kicking. Number two, if I retire from my job, I decide I want to collect Social Security, but I want to work part-time at a golf course or be a greeter at Walmart or something, the income that I collect, there is a ding, if you will, on me collecting my Social Security benefits. And I find it, I have a very hard time with that. If I've been told all my life I've paid into Social Security, which can help augment my retirement, which I'm also very responsible and put money into IRAs and 401ks and all that kind of stuff, but I have a hard time understanding whenever my time comes to collect Social Security, there's numerous ways that my benefits can be reduced simply because I may choose to work a little bit more.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that, Mark.
Well, two things. First of all, you're dying early, and I hope you don't. I really do.
Yeah, really. Mark, but, continued good health, I hope.
Yes, but that's all baked into the actuarial calculations that go into this. Yes, it's true. You wouldn't collect if you die before you turn to retirement age. But that's all baked in. It's all in there in the calculations. And will you get all your money out? Well, most I would say that a lot of people don't. Some do. I don't have the answer to that question. But on your second point, as I understand it, once you turn 66, you can make as much money as you want, that it's only until then. And also, by the way—
So if you wait till 66 to draw your check and you keep working part-time after age 66, you can double dip? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's as I understand it. And I have friends. I'm 66. I'm going through this. But I think it's important to recognize that part of the income tax that you pay on your Social Security does go back into the Social Security Trust Fund. It does not go into the general revenues. And that's part of what funds, actually it constitutes about 3% of the trust fund is income tax on Social Security benefits.
549-2937. What are your thoughts and comments about Social Security as tax reform takes center stage in Washington this week? Erastu in Mandarin. Erastu, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
When everybody is talking about deficit and the national debt we have, everybody talks about entitlements, which are not entitlements. These are the money we have paid, and they're paying us back. Nobody talks about the cost of perpetual invasive boars that we have outside, and they breed the money in this country. Why are we talking about the money that people have already paid, and we are paying them back without any interest, and they're not talking about the significant amount of money, trillions of dollars that we are every year in a perpetual war all over the world?
The military budget. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that. Three biggest drivers, and as you said, Social Security isn't the biggest driver of the deficit.
It's not a driver at all.
But Medicare, Medicaid, military spending certainly are.
Yes, that's true.
So what about his comments?
Well, let me get to military spending real quick, because I think that I think defense spending is something that everybody needs to think about. We have spent a lot of time recently pounding on our NATO allies to raise the amount that they spend on military or defense spending to 2% of their budget. Well, we're spending 16%. We spend as much on our military as we do on all other discretionary programs that are out there. And that's one reason why the House budget, which came out recently, and the administration's budget cuts all the social programs is because there's nowhere else to get the money.
They want to increase defense spending.
They want to make it closer to 18% of our budget. That simply, put simply, that affects the rest of our population and the benefits that they receive from the government for paying their taxes into the government very adversely.
What about the argument that we need a stronger defense? You don't buy that?
Well, I think that we have the strongest defense on earth. We spend more on our defense than almost every other country in the world combined. And we are the police of the world. There's no question about it, whether we like it or not, we are. But the question is, do we shore up social— you can put the question this way, and I'm not going to answer this question, but what I'm going to put out there is, do we need another aircraft carrier or do we save Social Security? What's the answer to that question? How do you feel about that? That would be a question that's worth at least mulling.
Well, you're a big hit on the show with that stark choice you're presenting, because the lines are jammed for John O'Brien of Flagler College and Vista Energy Group as we talk about the future of Social Security and tax reform. John is in St. John's. Hey, John, down in St. John's. How are you?
Good morning. Pretty good. And I do have a question about Social Security contributing to the debt. And I know that 99% of the time that people are telling you that, they're wrong. They may or may not understand why. But I think there's a circumstance where it possibly can. First off, the government's going to borrow whatever the government needs to borrow. And they're going to do that through debt instruments. Now, the difference is whether that's going to be public or private debt. And part of that is by statute, they have to loan the money to the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, that's all fine and good, but if we're in a situation where we are actually not running a deficit, we're running a surplus, they would still have to buy those bonds, or I should say sell those bonds to the trust funds, and when they are redeemed, there will be an interest cost on top of that. So with that thin sliver of a situation, would that actually cause Social Security to cost us a little bit of money?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Well, I think that you have to look at the federal debt overall. Again, 67% of the debt is owed back to Americans. It's not foreigners. But I think one particular stark thing is that, in a sense, there are those who want to blame the deficit on Social Security because it holds a lot of U.S. debt. Well, mutual funds in the U.S. hold $1.4 trillion in U.S. debt. Do we blame them? Do we blame the banks who hold $570 billion in notes from the federal government? The actual amount, we have a $20 trillion debt and we have about a $3 trillion Social Security debt. Well, all that other debt, is that contributing to the deficit? The answer really is no. We're borrowing that money because fiscally, our Congress spends more than we take in. It has nothing to do with the debt itself, except that it builds debt and those bonds have to be sold somewhere to somebody.
James in St. Mary's, Georgia this morning. Hey, James, how are things up in Georgia? Good morning.
Oh, it's a beautiful morning here. Thank you.
Sure.
I've got the week off, so this is the first time I've been able to call into your wonderful program.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for calling. And I hope you're enjoying your vacation.
We are. I wanted to point out that I think it's perhaps unjustified to consider Social Security as another, quote, benefit. I don't see it that way. When the legislation was established during the Roosevelt administration, it was not established as a benefit, but as a safeguard. And people were supposed to pay in advance their own money into the Social Security system so that their future could be, to a degree, safeguarded. And I think perhaps we sometimes make a mistake by simply grouping the Social Security Fund into the other benefit programs legislated by government. Also, just in full disclosure, I'm an Episcopal priest, so I think it's very important for me not to be political about things. But if any of my representatives are listening, I would like them to know that this is one of the few things that if someone tried to do away with it or reduce it, this is one of the few things that would probably cause me to take an active political stand. Thank you.
And what? Don't hang up. An active political stand in favor of what?
The Social Security system needs to be preserved. It cannot be reduced. We've paid into it. We deserve to get back what was agreed.
Okay. Thanks, James. Pastor James, it appears, up in St. Mary's, Georgia. And by the way, lots of tweets and emails about this coming in. Here's one, an email from a listener. The problem with our current Social Security system is that we have too many programs, benefits, and entitlements that we simply have no way of paying for. We need some reasonable cuts to the system to ensure that we can pay back 100% rather than 80% by the year 2034. However, those in Washington who were able to do this choose not to due to a lack of political will and courage. And here is a tweet from James. He tweets the show, "Tax me all day long for Social Security. I'd rather pay for my retirement than defense or POTUS trips to Mar-a-Lago." Okay, John O'Brien.
Well, I think, first of all, James, and by the way, thank you for the call. That was a beautiful call. But I think that the idea is benefits, you call them benefits. So the difference between an entitlement program, which is something that's established, which has to be paid for through taxes, and Social Security, which is not an entitlement program. You bought it. You paid for it. The difference is how it's paid for as we go forward. And I think that's important because now I'm 67 years old. I'm fine.
When did you, by the way, when did you start drawing Social Security?
62.
And okay.
I did that for a personal reason. I had an illness, and I thought, I'm not going to wait till I'm 66. But now I'm fine, by the way, for anybody who out there who cares. But I think what's important is that the structure of how it's paid for can be adjusted, and it should be, and it has been. Ronald Reagan in 1983 adjusted the taxes for Social Security and raised them in order to preserve the program. And that's, you know, Ronald Reagan is the stalwart of the anti-tax people out there to a certain extent, except he didn't. He raised taxes a number of times because he needed to. So if you want Social Security to be there for you when you're if you're 40 years old right now and you want Social Security to be there, you have to look at the fixes that are out there. And I can tell you the Republican fix and the Democratic fix.
And it's a big oversimplification to say this, but in the Republican fix involves scaling back benefits, right?
Yes.
The Democratic fix involves raising taxes.
Yes.
I mean, it's not surprising that those are the two proposals out there. Do you think that the two sides need to do a little bit of both?
Well, they could. And I think that when it comes down to it, when we get into this budget discussion, when you start to hear the howls that Social Security is a problem when it comes to our deficit, please recognize that that is a falsehood being thrown at you to get you to accept lower Social Security benefits, even though you already paid for them.
Ellis on the West Side. Hey, Ellis, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, just 2 points. The one gentleman complained about sometimes you might get people might not ever get back as much as they paid in, which I imagine statistically is rare for anybody with a long life. But when I was in high school, there was a gentleman that graduated the year before, immediate marriage, immediate child, and died in a construction accident. Well, his child got infinitely almost more money than was ever paid in for him, and I don't think anybody would begrudge that child or now adult that. And second, I will have the good fortune, Lord willing, that if I collect Social Security when I'm 70, that I will have to pay income tax. Does that money go back into Social Security?
Okay, thanks for that.
Well, first of all, when you're 70, you won't be paying income tax on the money you earn outside of Social Security. But I think that you mentioned the survivor benefits. I think it's important to point out about 10% of benefits get paid out to survivors. Survivors are parents and children. So, yes, there is a lot of that. But in terms of whether you'll get all your money or not, again, the actuarial is let's contemplate how often people die and when they die, and then let's put those into the equations. And the fact is that that is already baked into the entire calculation.
Quick comment for you from our Facebook page from Jim. How much of our national credit rating is based on the size of the Social Security Trust Fund?
Well, the Social Security Trust Fund is about 15% of our national debt. In other words, the Social Security surplus that you all paid in has been lent to the federal government, just like the Chinese, who own about 10% of our debt, actually less than that now. The other entities, like I mentioned, the mutual funds in the United States own $1.4 trillion of the debt. So the credit rating of the United States is really more influenced by the willingness of Congress to pay the debt. And we have a debt ceiling vote coming up. When you see Congress in any way decide, oh, we got to pull back on that, we may not want to pay it, that affects our credit rating. Really, nothing else does. The United States is the gold standard of credit in the world.
Your final thoughts on how this program is going to factor into the discussions we anticipate over the coming weeks?
It's going to come up, and it's going to come up because folks like the Heritage Foundation, which is a very conservative think tank, is going to come around and say, hey, we have to cut that. It's not sustainable. It makes the debt go up. And there's going to be responses. I think that what's really got to happen is that the people out there that are listening to this radio station now and listening to your show have to realize that they have to push back. They have to say, no, I paid for it, I want it, and whatever solutions we can put together, as long as they don't hurt anybody, then what we want to do is see that happen. We want to have the benefit of our Social Security retirement.
As always, thanks for joining us with your thoughts on this. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
Dr. John O'Brien of Vista Energy Group and Flagler College. Much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the Jags' hopes for the new season as training camp gets underway this week. But up next, First Coast Success profiles local CEO and philanthropist Barbara Drake. Back in a moment.
Like most of us, your paycheck is smaller than you think it ought to be. That happens for a reason, you know.
Withholding and its close companion, information reporting, is absolutely necessary to get compliance with the tax laws.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tax withholding, whence it came. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Planning ahead can save lives. To help you develop a plan to protect yourself and your family, visit JacksReady.com or download the JacksReady app and pick up a 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide at your public library. Tune your radio to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by ServPro of Jacksonville South and of Arlington.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
She's a North Florida business leader who founded and sold two recycling companies over her career, and these days, she's very active in the community, especially with local charities United Way and Jasmine. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with CEO and philanthropist Barbara Drake.
Barbara Drake can talk trash in a good way. Drake is retired after 40 years in the waste and recycling industries, including two decades as an entrepreneur with different ventures. She also is active in the community, especially with the United Way of Northeast Florida, Leadership Jacksonville, and Jasmine. Barbara Drake, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
You grew up in Indiana. You earned your MBA and your undergraduate at the University of West Florida. How did you decide to join the waste management and recycling industry?
When I left the Air Force, I sent applications to many companies, and I chose a paper manufacturing company, a subsidiary of Mobil Oil. I was hired as a controller, but I started my training working 2 to 3 weeks in every part of the paper mill. Over time, everyone complained about our recycling division, said it was a real problem. They were responsible for supplying all of our paper for the paper manufacturing process. When it was time for me to be promoted, I asked to go to the recycling division because I thought there would be an opportunity for advancement. I was quickly sent to Philadelphia as a regional controller. And after a few years, I moved to Jacksonville to manage the recycling plant on Beaver Street.
What was it like moving to Jacksonville at that point?
I wasn't excited about it. I was in Philadelphia and loved it. I had a 14-year-old son, and I had lived in the Panhandle for many years, and I knew the challenges with racism. And I was concerned about bringing a teenager to Jacksonville and introducing him to that attitude. But over time, I've seen it change, and I've been very, very pleased I moved here, and I love the city.
Well, you've been very active in that change.
While I was in the recycling business, the city started the recycling program, and everyone was talking recycling. I was asked to be a speaker at Leadership Jacksonville to explain what was going on, and I spoke several different years, and then I was invited or nominated to become a participant in Leadership Jacksonville in 1991-92, and it changed my life. I got to learn about what was going on in Jacksonville, where needs were, challenges, what we were doing right, and I couldn't stay away from it. I got very involved.
And you remain very involved.
I've remained very involved. I stayed on the board for a lot of years, was ultimately president of the board, and when Eleanor Ashby, our long-term executive director, retired, I was on the search committee, and we had a break with no executive director, and I volunteered to fill that gap while we were looking for a new leader.
Well, you've had a lot of leadership roles, both in the community and, of course, in business, and you've worked for large companies, you've helped build companies, and you've run your own companies. What's the difference between working for a larger company and being an entrepreneur and really taking a business in your own hands and growing it?
In great big bold letters, cash flow. I had to learn how to buy what I absolutely needed and what I knew I could sell, immediately process it so I could sell it, ship it out as fast as I could, and collect the money. And I had never had to do that working for the military or working in corporate America. So it was a real change.
You don't necessarily make it sound easy, but you certainly have distilled it to its essence and how to make a business work.
You have to distill it. You have to be focused on what needs to be done and get it done fast and turn that inventory as fast as you can.
Now, what sort of inventory are you talking about when you talk about the waste and recycling industry?
We had bales. We produced bales of paper that weighed 1,000 to 2,000 pounds each. We had cardboard, newspaper, computer paper then, office paper, white paper, colored paper, and all kinds of different papers that are specialty papers. And we got the paper from individuals and from businesses that had overissue that needed to be sold. And then we sold that to specific manufacturers in the United States and all over the world based on their specific quality requirements. And the requirements were very stringent.
Now, you've been in the business for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, is this a business you thought about joining?
I didn't even know it existed, except I knew my dad picked up scrap and took it to a metals recycler when I was young. But that's all I knew about the industry.
Talk about growing up. You grew up in Indiana. And
yes.
What did you do? What did you want to be when you were a child?
I had no vision of what I could be. My parents, we were very poor. My mother graduated from high school. My father couldn't read or write, did not think girls should be educated. And so the only vision I ever had was that I would marry and be a mother. When I was in high school, a recruiter sent postcards to everyone saying, take the test to see if you can get in the military, get in the Air Force. So I decided to take the test to see how smart I was. And he started soliciting me to join. And when I was 2 weeks after I graduated from high school, I joined the Air Force, knowing absolutely nothing about the military. I was the first in my family to go in.
And you were in for a while.
I was enlisted for several years, got married, and when I became pregnant, the policy was to immediately discharge a woman if she were pregnant. And so I got out, worked civil service, got transferred to the Panhandle of Florida, and decided to go to college. And I went to the University of West Florida, got my bachelor's and master's in business administration. And at that time, the military changed their policies based on a lawsuit and allowed women to go in to the military as an officer and retain custody of their children before they had to give up custody if they were an officer and enlisted could never have been pregnant. So I applied for that, and I was in the first officer training class after that law became effective in 1972.
See, you continue to be a part of change.
Well, I was a recipient of change more than making a change.
What else would you like to share?
Jacksonville is a great city. I'm glad I was transferred here. It's my home, and I'm here to stay.
Well, Barbara Drake, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
All right, and finally, this hour. All eyes will be on Blake Bortles today as Jaguars training camp kicks off.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
This after a bad Saturday night practice for the team. Cole Pepper here now with more. After working late last night at that Armada game, hey, I saw you out in the broadcast booth. You sounded great, as always, and looked great on TV. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a busy time with training camp underway and the Armada kicking off the fall season. We'll get to soccer here in just a moment, but it is going to be very interesting to see how Blake Bortles bounces back after a Saturday night training camp practice in which he threw five interceptions. It was the first practice in full pads for the team as well. Now, if this was Tom Brady or Drew Brees or somebody, we probably wouldn't give it much of a thought. Mm-hmm. Just maybe it would become an interesting footnote. But because Bortles struggled last year and because this is going to be a career path defining season for him, there's a lot of scrutiny. Bortles has to be better, no doubt about that. He has to get his confidence back. He has to start getting confidence back from his teammates, who maybe aren't saying right now that they've lost confidence in him. But when you've struggled as you did last year, when you threw the number of interceptions you have the last several years, and then you have a bad practice that first time out, it's not something that's irreparable. Mark Brunell tweeted out that throwing five interceptions in practice is not a big deal. The big deal is how you bounce back after that.
Sure.
And Monday's a new day, and here we are on Monday, a chance for him to try to turn things around. Certainly, his teammates can have hope or faith in him, but there hasn't been enough shown by Bortles on the field that he can be the guy just yet. Again, it's just one practice. Very easy to overreact, but when you have a small sample size, that's all you had to choose from, and he's got to bounce back starting today.
So many hopes have been pinned on this guy.
Well, they've done so many things to try to bring in talent around him on that offensive side of the football, not the least of which being drafting Leonard Fournette, that they hope will take some of the burden off Bortles and turn the Jaguars into a more running-based offense. But in this day and age in the National Football League, your quarterback has to be able to complete passes, and you have to not turn the ball over. And again, this is Doug Marrone's team as the head coach, but Tom Coughlin is back as the grand poobah of all things football at the Jaguars. And one thing that we know about Tom Coughlin, he does not like to turn the ball over.
Hmm.
So that's going to be a big part of what Bortles does in his progress this week. One of the other position battles, by the way, that I'm watching, Melissa, is at left tackle. The Jaguars traded for Brandon Albert, a former Pro Bowler, in the offseason. They also drafted Cam Robinson. And those two have sort of been alternating working with the first team to see if the Jaguars would go rookie at left tackle or go with the veteran at left tackle. It's going to be something we'll be following throughout the course of training camp in the preseason.
And they are in full pads all this week, right?
They are, yeah, including Friday's family night, which is sort of the new version of the scrimmage that may not include what most people would necessarily consider to be a scrimmage this year. Still waiting to hear exactly what the plan is for that event, but pads all the way through. So, listen, Doug Marrone wants to create toughness in this team, and putting them in pads and making them work is certainly one way to do that.
All right. Let's talk soccer for a minute. By the way, I took in my very first Armada game last night, thanks to Paul Sifton of 927 Events for the invite. Lots of fun to watch the game and also see Cole Pepper busting out his magic in the broadcast booth. Very nice to see you doing that. But it was a really exciting game to watch.
Yeah, and there was some energy in the building, I thought, as well yesterday. It was the first match since Robert Palmer purchased the team. Jacksonville.
And he is not addicted to love.
No.
It's somebody else.
Is that somebody? Although I did note that they did play that before the game.
Oh, did they?
A little nod.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was, I thought, a noticeable increase in excitement and energy around the park. Some of that may have been fueled by the large video board that was brought in to supplement the scoreboard at UNF's Hodges Stadium. Jacksonville, though, with a 1-1 draw against San Francisco, one of the other contending teams in the North American Soccer League, the Armada will go on the road to Puerto Rico and then North Carolina before returning home in 2.5 weeks to play in Jacksonville. Palmer, by the way, has made a difference already. He's acquired 3 goal-scoring threats. Tony Taylor, a former Bishop Kenny and Jacksonville University star included, a guy who has played for the Panamanian national team. His parents are Panamanian and who has played in MLS and professionally in Portugal. He has not yet gotten going on the field with the team, but that should happen this week. So making a difference early on with an infusion of money.
Last but not least, Cole says another Jacksonville native had a very good week. It's Caleb Dressel.
Yeah, the former Clay High School and Florida Gator had an amazing week at the World Championships of Swimming. He's just the second man ever to win 7 gold medals at a swimming world championship. His last gold was yesterday when he helped the United States win the 4x100 medley relay. The only other man to win 7 gold medals in a world championship. Let me know if you've heard of this guy, Michael Phelps.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
You etch your name next to Michael Phelps in the record books, and you're doing something all right. He was also chosen as the outstanding male athlete of the entire competition. So hats off to Caleb Dressel. Congratulations. And certainly it'll be a force to be reckoned with when the Olympics roll around again.
Very nice to see that. And follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Download the Sam and Cole podcast for all your sports news and notes. See you next week.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.